My pleasure.
So let's talk about the current state of satellite manufacturing. Your company aims to mass manufacture small satellites. Is that what's already happening in the industry now, or is this kind of a new path forward?
Well, it's somewhat new. The first mass manufacturing of satellites was really Iridium, which was a telephone system back in about 2000 was when they launched. And back then it was 100 and some odd satellites, which for this industry is definitely mass manufacturing. You know, historically, these devices have been put together one by one, very bespoke and custom and each one individual. And what we're finding today is that what Iridium started so many decades ago has become somewhat more the norm and becoming the norm on an industrial scale that this industry hasn't seen before. Last year, there were over 1,200 satellites launched. A good majority of those were built by SpaceX. They're Starlink satellites. There are a large number of even smaller CubeSats and somewhere between Starlink and CubeSats being built in large numbers. So this is a phenomenon, I think, that really kind of retraces the history of the PC versus the mainframe computer, if you're old enough to remember that. When I was in college, I would have to traipse through the snow in northern Utah to go up to the university and use the computer because there was only one on campus, and we had to all go into the computer building where it was at and fight over terminals to get computer access time. And over time, by the time I was in graduate school, we had PCs in our homes, which we could do the same work and more in our homes. And now what we see is swarms of these computers worldwide now do things such as transfer cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. And you're starting to see the same phenomenon happening in satellites, where people are discovering that the large amount of satellites, albeit smaller, like the microcomputers were to the mainframe, can actually do a lot more. So it's a case of 2 + 2 = 8, really.
Right.
In this case,
the technology is developing so that it's smaller and easier to get them into space and utilize them. But I mean, is there anything else driving this need for mass manufacturing? I mean, what?
Well, there's a couple of underlying reasons why it becomes possible. First of all, and you know, if you go back to Iridium, you know, that era, there was others who, Craig McGraw, for example, wanted to put up thousands of communication satellites, but it was, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars by the end of where they figured out what it would cost. And so that kind of capital expenditure was prohibitive, at least at the risk level of deploying that many satellites. You know, that was just considered unrealistic. So the costs have come down immensely for satellite technology over the last 20 years in particular. And it's made it possible to build lots of these for hundreds of thousands of dollars each, for example. Mm-hmm. And so that's been an enabling factor. The other enabling factor is the size of the technology makes the launching of these much easier, because everything's smaller and lighter. And a launch generally is priced based on, you know, how many kilos you're sending up and to where. So apart from that, you asked about use cases. And yes, the use cases are expanding as people discover them. It's a little bit of the chicken and egg here. Until you really can afford to do these sort of things, you only have the dreamers that think of use cases for, you know, hundreds of satellites in orbit. And once it becomes a fiscal and technical reality like it is now, people are actually starting to build these things. So that's happening at the same time. The availability of capital for space innovation has grown immensely, and that we really owe that to SpaceX. So, mm-hmm. you know, when SpaceX came along back in 2000, you know, Elon says, we're going to build a rocket ourselves. You could be thrown in an insane asylum for saying that back then, but now mm-hmm. we see it's the norm. This was once a purely state dominated industry, and, you know, SpaceX proving that, you know, bright people with a mission and an idea in mind that they can do this themselves really sucks the oxygen out of the room of the government industry. So that's created the pathway for others to fund these sort of things. So the use cases are you know, we don't know what they're going to be in the future, mainly telecommunication and Earth observation today. But I feel like the space economy is really much akin to the New World economy back in the 1500s when Spaniards stood on the shore of Spain watching the ships leave to the New World and come back full of gold. Nobody had any clue what the New World would be some, you know, 400 years later, and here we are.
Jim, you mentioned it, you know, you mentioned SpaceX lowering the cost of access to space, and they kind of paved the way for some other small sat launchers that are coming online. I'm thinking, you know, Rocket Labs, Firefly, even SpaceX's rideshare program, there's Relativity Space. Is the emergence of having rides to space also driving the mass manufacturing industry, or is it vice versa, or is it happening in parallel? I guess, you know, how does the small sat launchers play into the development of this industry?
It's a really great question. I guess one of the advantages I have is being a human barnacle in this industry. I was around when a lot of this stuff was first discussed and then eventually implemented. But you know, I was around, you know, when rideshare was kind of evolving, and it was somebody realizing, hey, there's a little bit of extra space available on a government launch, and you know, can we stick a little CubeSat or something like that alongside the big satellite? And this evolved into what we call today rideshare. You know, that was 30 years ago when this really first started, and it was really again done in the government for government sponsored payloads. The commercial side of it really took off about 15 years ago with something called the ESPA ring, which was sponsored again by the government, the U.S. Air Force, and made it possible to stick larger size satellites as secondaries around, sort of if you imagine a wedding ring below the satellite, and each one of the diamonds would be a satellite stuck on instead of a diamond. That's really what the ESPA ring looks like. You know, the commercial side of this has picked up on it and has evolved to using a lot of Russian assets, although that's less the case now because they're simply running out of decommissioned ICBMs. The Indians became very active in this, the Chinese, and then finally the U.S. So what's emerging, though, is, you know, SpaceX is really perfected the large reusable launch vehicle, which really forms kind of one economic system where you're lifting, you know, primary satellites and then a whole bevy of rideshare satellites. On the other side of this, as you alluded to, is the small launchers. And that becomes a second economic competing system with the large reusable. And when you mass manufacture, by mass manufacturing, incidentally, we're talking hundreds a year. We're not talking millions a year. If you go to the auto industry, you know, they're literally producing millions of cars a year. And I think we can argue today at a much better quality than ever before and for a lower price for what you get than ever before. So you see the power of the learning curve of this repetitive process that gets better and better technology to you, more reliable at a lower cost. And so that's the idea behind the small launchers. We at Phantom are building a small launcher ourselves. That's one of our chief activities. And we see, you know, companies like Rocket Lab, who really are building the small launcher, but aren't thinking about the mass manufacturing side of it to compete with SpaceX. They just announced that they're basically going to build a Falcon 9 size vehicle. Mm-hmm. So they're going to move into that other economic system. So I'm very bullish personally about the idea of mass manufacturing small vehicles to cover what today is about a third of the market financially, but it's about 80% of the number of satellites launched. We think over time that's going to become at least half, if not maybe two thirds, of the dollars in the market. And there's going to be a need to service that. And what small satellites really truly need is not rideshare. They need to actually go where they want when they want, because there's some hidden costs with rideshare that most people don't think about. You can look at the price SpaceX charges you, but on the other hand, there's the cost of integrating onto that wedding ring, if you will. There's, you know, often up to $1 million per satellite cost of engineering that particular solution, because again, it's a unique situation every time. And then the second thing is the cost of delay. And then the third thing people don't think about is once you're up there, if you're not in the place you need to be, you have to have propulsion to move around. Mm-hmm. And that could cost upwards of $1 million. So if we eliminate those costs and can match or go below the cost of rideshare, we think that's going to be a dominant factor in the future.
I want to talk a little bit about your plans for Phantom Space, but before we do that, you mentioned these use cases are still, you know, evolving and developing, but you mentioned communication and Earth observation. And I've got to imagine that the U.S. government or, you know, national security would have an interest in both of those use cases. Mm-hmm. How is the government leveraging this smaller technology and utilizing mass manufacturing of these satellites for communication and for Earth observation now, or is this something that they really should be looking at for the future?
So another great question, actually. Until very recently, the answer would be no, they haven't been utilizing it very much at all. They've been a very slow adopter of this, primarily, I would say, because of the risk involved with it. However, just today, I noticed when I scanned the news before I got on here, the Space Development Agency is procuring 150 more satellites for what they call their space communications layer. Mm-hmm. And they're going to procure it from a number of different vendors, so they don't have what they call vendor vapor lock. And, you know, in the old days, you would pick Lockheed or Boeing or Northrop or somebody like that to build your constellation of satellites. The price would go from $10 billion to $40 billion, and then the program would get canceled. Mm-hmm. And I spent some of my career on those kinds of satellite constellations. So it was not so much mass manufacturing in the old days in the government system, but was a lot of single unit manufacturing spread over a lot of buildings, if you can imagine that. So sort of parallel building these bespoke satellites all at once. And so you didn't get the cost effect of it. What we're finding is now the government is starting to adopt the commercial practices, and they're going to satellite providers that, you know, prior to this, you would never have expected to be, you know, providing national defense systems, you know, primarily commercial companies. So like the iPhone, which or the microcomputer, which the government doesn't build, they buy, you know, that's where all this industry goes eventually, is to the government adopting the commercial solution. Mm-hmm. And then using it in their particular use case.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a bit about Phantom Space. I mean, what is the plan for your company? Sure. To kind of fill these gaps and, you know, give both government and other commercial operators, you know, additional options for manufacturing satellites and launching them? I mean, what's your plan?
So Phantom Space was formed with the idea of servicing the next generation of commercial and government space operations. And our products really cover the whole range of getting to space, moving around in space, and coming back from space. Much like the New World Economy, you know, we don't know what the future is in space. We don't know what the ultimate killer app is, if you will. But we do know that anything that wants to operate in space has to get there, move around, and come back. So to that end, our product line includes a small launcher fleet, which will launch up to several hundred a year. And we also build satellites that can operate in space, again, using our mass manufacturing basic approach that we've developed for the launch vehicle. Mm-hmm. And so our customers can come with their payload, with their idea, and we can help them implement it. And it serves to really lower the barrier to entry for a lot of folks. They don't have to be experts in these somewhat esoteric things. We also build propulsion that moves the satellites around, and including you know, lunar landers and things like that. We've been involved in those already, and eventually reentry systems.
Mm-hmm. And you said that propulsion is extremely important when it comes to these small satellites, right? To get it to where it needs to go.
Yeah, often that's the case. You are in a non-optimal orbit if you're a rideshare, or you know, if you're going to move beyond Earth, propulsion's a big deal. So, you know, these lunar landers look a lot like our small launchers in terms of the technology that's inside of them. So that's a natural extension of what we're doing. And we try to keep our technology focus really narrow to, you know, a certain set of capabilities. But we find that the satellites and the landers and the launch vehicles, small launch vehicles, all share the same basic technology that we can implement in a bunch of different product lines.
Mm-hmm. With, you know, with mass manufacturing ramping up from all these different use cases that are evolving from new government customers, what kind of effect will this industry have on the economy? I've got to assume when you say manufacturing, that means more jobs. I mean, are we looking 5, 10, 15 years down the track of this industry having a pretty decent impact on the economy?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question because I think it happens at a couple of different levels. So you mentioned, you know, how many jobs this is create on the ground. So the, you know, sort of the core manufacturing, the auto assembly kinds of jobs, you know, are non-trivial. They're probably, you know, right now in the hundreds of thousands, but, you know, we'll reach millions as time goes on. I think the bigger impact becomes what are the secondary jobs that result from, you know, the use cases. So mm-hmm. right now in the space industry, there's about $600 billion a year in revenue going back and forth. And most of that results from just moving bits from place A to place B or utilizing space assets. And it's already impacting us in ways we don't think about normally. I mean, if you watch satellite TV, all that's going through satellites in orbit. If you listen to XM radio, Sirius XM, that all goes through orbit. If you make phone calls, a lot of times that stuff bounces through orbit. I've got internet systems that bounce through orbit. Mm-hmm. And any phone you have that has any GPS system in it also uses orbital signals. So, excuse me, ability to use these GPS satellites, for example, to guide deliveries. I mean, every time you Amazon order something, space gets involved in it, right? In mm-hmm. multiple ways. So it's really hard to measure that impact. But I think the way to think of space is sort of like buildings in a place like Manhattan, and elevator technology is really akin to space transportation technology, what we're building. You know, Manhattan has a certain finite amount of space on the ground, but the way we expanded the floor space in Manhattan was to go vertical with skyscrapers. And so the space economy is kind of the same thing. In other words, you can you really create the possibility for more economic results. It's creating a bigger pie for everybody by expanding into space. You can do things there that you can't do terrestrially. You can do them much, much better. And that's where you're going to see a lot of the job creation. And so it'll be in the kinds of high-paying jobs that we really want to see in this country, not just a service sector McDonald's job, but, you know, the kinds of things where, you know, you have a lot of intellectual property and invention happening. It's precisely where I think every country really wants to be, is to have that kind of economy.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Jim, you know, you are someone who has been in this industry for quite some time. Kind of looking at your crystal ball, what does the future look like for these mass manufactured small satellites and small launchers? I mean, are we just coming into a new era of this industry in the next 5 years, 10 years, 15 years? I mean, how far out are we and what does the future look like?
Well, so if you're old enough to remember when the internet started, you know, in 1995, when I came back from Europe, I discovered this thing called Mosaic that I could get on and browse this new World Wide Web. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't find anything but self-promotion and porn, really, at that mm-hmm. point. It was hard to imagine that we would buy almost everything we need through this portal. So today in space looks like the internet did in about 1998, when you're starting to see some shape to it about how people make money, and it's about to explode. And I don't believe that it's anywhere near maturity. And if I look, you know, 10 years down the road, you know, most of the others who prognosticate on these sort of things see a $2 trillion economy. Right now it's, you know, $600 billion, so 0.6. So tripling of the dollars, you know, you keep looking even further, what you're going to see is a much more visible aspect of space in our everyday life. It'll be an integrated part of what we do, much in the same way that the internet has become absolutely integrated in our life every day. I think that's really the perfect analogy for how we'll see space in the near term. In the long term, you're going to see people moving to places like Mars. And at first, it'll be a trickle. But then eventually, as we figure this out, there will be human colonies on Mars, maybe in my lifetime, but certainly in my grandchildren's lifetime. And you'll see a larger and larger human population gradually stretching out into the cosmos. And it's in our DNA to do that. So that's why I'm so very sure that we will reach out and do just that. You'll see people living in orbit. If you listen to Jeff Bezos, his philosophy is that, and this is why he started Blue, is he believes that the Earth should be the residential zone and space should be the industrial zone. So you'll see an increase in space-based manufacturing. You'll see an increase in extraterrestrial resource utilization, bringing stuff back from the moon, from asteroids, places like that are useful to our life here on Earth.
Mm-hmm. Sounds interesting. 1998 is when I got my first Prodigy account, so I can only imagine what is to come.
Right, exactly. I mean, we used to have to dial up somebody else's computer to talk and exchange information. We still talk to satellites the same way today. That's literally how far back in technology we are in the space business.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating stuff. So much to look forward to. We've been speaking with Jim Cantrell. He's the CEO and founder of Phantom Space. Jim, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.